usually bring guests back more than once. I mean, most of the people come through once. First of all, there's a lot of people to choose from. Secondly, I feel like most of the time when I have on a guest, that guest usually tells me everything he or she's going to say, and then we're kind of done. But there are guests that I find that are constantly on top of things, constantly changing, and always have something new to add. And this gentleman that we're about to have on is one of those people. As I mentioned to you earlier, I told you the story of when I saw David give a presentation at an economic conference in Florida about a year and a half ago. And it really struck me when he got up because he was so young compared to some of the other economists that were presenting at that time. And I thought before he said anything, I said, what does this guy have to say because he's so young? Well, I was amazed. And by the end of the his presentation, I knew that we wanted to have him on. In fact, I went to the back of the room and talked to him before he left, and he's been gracious enough to come on. And now he's gracious enough to join us again. So I've got with us today David McIlvaney, CEO of McIlvaney Financial Companies, which includes the International Collectors Associates, ICA Europe, McIlvaney Wealth Management, and he's a director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold. Welcome back to the show, David.
Great to be back with you, Mike.
Thank you. And Peggy says that you've been traveling overseas, but she wasn't quite sure where. I think it's Asia. Is that correct?
Yeah, we spent a number of weeks in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Beijing. We're just returning here in the last 24 or 48 hours.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, because you probably still have a little jet lag. What did you see when you were over there? Because we've been hearing, of course, as you know, before you left, because we've been hearing it for quite some time now, that China, you know, there's the argument, is China going to have a hard landing, a soft landing? What did you see over there?
You know, confirmation of what we had assumed, which is the slowing trend there in the economy. It has to do with an economic model which is ultimately not sustainable. And, you know, there was a transition probably 10 years ago from a more or less export-based economy to something that was driven largely by government spending, and infrastructure projects became and still are north of 50% of GDP in China. And that is ultimately not sustainable. You compare that to any other country in the world, and it's 2, 3, 4, 5 times the amount of government spending directly into the economy on these building projects. And now you have entire cities which are literally empty, but they're hopeful that there will continue to be a migration from the agrarian culture to, you know, a suburban culture or a citified culture.
So now what you're telling me, because I'm sure you've seen it, and I saw, I guess it was BBC or somebody did, they did a show on that, and they went to some of these cities, and there was literally there was a policeman in the middle of an intersection, and there was no traffic for him to take care of. There was nobody in the city. But then I had another guest on one time that subsequent to that that refuted that and said, well, you know, basically what the Chinese do is they build these cities and then they bring all the people into them. The truth is that they do have those cities that literally where they have very few inhabitants?
Yeah, no, that's exactly the case. There are a number of cities which have very few inhabitants, and I think a lot of this is predicated on what you were commenting on in the last segment. As you see U.S. consumption in decline and European consumption in decline, our economies have everything to do with these people having a place to show up to work. I mean, you can't move people from working the farm to working a factory job and living in the city if they, in fact, don't have that factory job in the city, which is supplying goods and services to the larger world. And you know, you're looking still at the two largest consumers of Chinese goods being Europe and America. So what happens here in terms of our credit cycles and specifically consumption trends has everything to do with sort of the edge, if you will, of the economy in China. So that's where we see a continued slowing trend in China.
So do you see a GDP? I mean, they've come down from around 11 down to about 7.5. Do you see it slowing down even lower than that?
3 to 4% is where I think we'll be as you move 2, 3, 4 years out from now. 3 to 4%. But the beauty of that is really that you're moving towards something that is long-term sustainable, and you can't have your cake and eat it too. If to see these double-digit growth rates which they've had, and it's been largely based on malinvestment, bad investment directed by the government, to something that is more internally consumption-oriented, where you increase the wages of a growing middle class, and you increase the value of the currency and thus the purchasing power of households, these two components would imply slower growth, but more, I guess you could say, sustainable growth. And that's actually good news. Not good news for sort of, you know, having an oar in the water and pulling for the global economy, but certainly more stable in terms of the economy there in China.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that would, as you say, that would be a very sustainable figure and one that's more normalized as compared to the rest of the world. It would seem to me like that would bring a lot of political upheaval, though, in China. And we'll have to touch on that when we get back. If you'll just stay with us, David, got a few more questions to ask you about this. Folks, you're listening to David McIlvaney. David is CEO of McIlvaney Financial Companies and one of our favorite guests, and we've got a lot to ask him, so stay with us. We're going to have a great show. You're listening to Mike Robertson, Straight Talk Money Business, 1110 KTK, where you get straight answers to your questions about your money. Back to you in just a few moments. Welcome back, folks. We have one of our favorite guests, and one I think one of the brightest guys around, and it's David McIlvaney. David is CEO of McIlvaney Financial Companies, which includes the International Collectors Associations, ICA of Europe, the McIlvaney Wealth Management Group, and he is director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold. And we're going to get to a few questions about gold in just a moment. I just have one other question about China, David. What do you see as the political fallout here? Because there's obviously going to be some political fallout on this because, you know, the guys in power tend to keep their jobs by providing jobs for everyone else, and it seems to me like they're going to go through a little weak patch.
You're exactly right. I mean, the sticking point is that there has to be political reforms. You know, the recent 300-page roadmap laid out by the World Bank adequately addresses all of the economic reforms that need to take place over the next several years for this transition to occur to a slower growth but sustainable growth model and away from sort of dependence on the Western world. And the issue is really that you have entrenched political interests, and you have any estimates range from 4% on the low end to 17% on the high end of graft. You know, literally 17% is the high end estimate of gross domestic product in China that goes to theft, corruption, graft. I mean, this is a very corrupt system, and if you are in the political elite, you are one of the 5,000 members of the Communist Party who has a cumulative net worth of over $90 billion. So, you know, the reforms threaten your franchise, and you really don't want to see any change whatsoever. And yet, if there is not change, within 3 to 5 years, you'll have a banking crisis and a depression to rival that of the 1930s here in the United States, only you have a lot more angry people in China than you ever did in the United States, certainly circa the 1930s.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I see coming. I don't know how it's going to – I don't think how it's going to play out, but certainly there are going to be some significant changes. Talking about an area with significant changes, and I know you travel extensively. That's I think that's one of the things, one of the many factors that makes your perspective so unique is so many economists – tend to stay in their I was in New York last week. I can't say all those concrete buildings or ivory towers, but they tend not to get out of their region very much. But you travel extensively both in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. Let's talk a little bit about that. What do you see? What is your prognosis on Europe? Are we going to lose the Eurozone? Is Germany going to leave? Is Greece going to leave? What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, Europe obviously is a mess, and I think what we can't underestimate is the resolve amongst the political elite to put something or keep something in play. Now, I think the reality is Greece will have to leave, and Spain may voluntarily go, and all you're really looking for is sort of a radical leadership to emerge saying, first, we're Spain, we're not Europeans, and sort of hearkening back to an era of nationalism. And this, I think, is going to affect some of the countries in Europe, with many of the countries still sticking together. So shrinkage is really what we would see in the Eurozone with a more core group of members still in play. You know, Germany has the most to lose. Leaving the Eurozone, they've seen a significant benefit in terms of trade surplus dollars, it also creates a tremendous downside for them, this idea of shrinkage. So, they have the most to lose, and I think that's probably where the greatest risk lies, probably the unspoken risk. Everyone is focused on the PIGS, that acronym, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. But actually, if you're looking at economic downside, any real change to the Eurozone will have the most dramatic effects on Germany.
Oh, really? Well, but now Germany don't they have a vested interest to try to kind of keep this together? I mean, they sell so much to this region, and it's helped them in so many ways. Isn't it their best interest to try to keep the Eurozone together?
They do, yeah, it is. And it really what they're dickering over at this point is what will the terms be? Because they don't want to, without having some skin in the game from your partner countries, they don't want to subsidize the southern or less productive countries. And so they're having to have these countries sort of sign in blood what they will commit to fiscally before Germany starts footing the bill, because it's not going to be carte blanche. And that's where Merkel, I think, has done a pretty remarkable job bringing a number of these countries to the brink as a negotiation tactic, if you will, so that the ECB and ultimately the Bundesbank is not footing the bill irresponsibly. That would be very, very upsetting, I think, to the German people if that were to be the case. So I think actually there's quite a bit of skilled brinksmanship, skilled negotiation tactics taking place. But I think you have to look and say it's messy and going to get a lot messier before there's real resolution. But I think you're looking now at values in a number of European countries in their equity markets, which are attractive. The real downside is, say, for instance, a number of companies that I like in Spain, should Spain leave the euro and move back to its peseta background, guess what happens? You're probably going to see a 40 to 50% devaluation. And in spite of attractive price-earnings ratios and an attractive fundamental analysis, if you will, into their equity space, you can still see 40 to 50% downside, even with things attractively priced today. So I think that's what makes this really tough as an investor to embrace, and you still have to be sort of hands-off and cautious at this point.
Okay, yeah, because you anticipated my question. I was going to ask you if you were bargain hunting in Europe, but I assume from what you're saying is that you're still holding off, waiting to see if the other shoe will fall.
Yeah, reasonable dividend yields and very attractive price earnings multiples, just as two of probably a dozen different metrics that could be applied. And again, that's where you have to look at a big picture, because politically, if a country pulls the plug in terms of its commitment to the Eurozone project, that implies moving back to whether it is the drachma in Greece or, you've seen over 90% decline in equity values in Greece. You've seen a 60 to 80% decline in equity values in Italy and Spain. And for the value investor, you may be licking your chops, but the issue is, if you neglect what happens in a currency devaluation, you can still, having bought cheaply, still suffer 40 to 50% declines. And because that's largely how they will address an overabundance of debt. It would be through the devaluation process, which is classically how countries have handled too much debt. They just pay it off with a cheaper currency. And this is the heart of the Eurozone issue. When you're not in control of your own currency, you can't devalue and take away the pressure of too much debt. And that's really what has people hamstrung, particularly in the more socialist countries in Europe who don't like austerity and feel that is an undue punishment to certain segments within the culture.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. I was looking at a Spanish telephone company, Telefonica, and they recently completely cut out their dividend. Now, I got from reading their information that basically what they were doing is they were accumulating cash, because they're a very profitable company, but they're accumulating cash just so they didn't have to go to the market and borrow in these tough times because it'd be so expensive for them. Do you see many companies doing things like that over there?
Yeah, and I mean that's a great example, because it's a company that has a franchise that spans not only through Spain but through other parts of Eastern Europe and Central and South America. I mean, it's interesting for a lot of reasons, and I think they're making a tough choice in terms of cutting their dividend, but a smart choice in the short run, and they can basically self-finance. There are a number of companies over there that I think are a far better bet, you know, compared to, say, Spanish debt, as an example. Yeah, this is a time frame where I think the investor has to, and this is the moving, shifting focus to the U.S., you have much better bets in corporate bonds than you do in sovereign paper. Everyone is clamoring for the safety of treasuries, but I think implicit to this is the intransigence of government to really fix anything at the fiscal level, which ultimately is going to show just how impaired the U.S. balance sheet is. And when you contrast that with the corporate sector, which has been aggressively paying off debt, changing the debt structure, I think you have a much healthier debt structure in corporate America than you do, you know, at the federal level. So, you know, this is the same thing in miniature in Europe, and I think the strains that you've seen in Europe are coming to a theater near you here in the United States over the next 6, 12, 18 months. So that's what I think we have to be cautious with, is to assume that Europe is the epicenter. It's really not. The U.S. is the epicenter, and all we have is sort of a foreshock in Europe.
Right. You're absolutely, yeah, you're right. We are the epicenter, and we're still the prettiest girl at the dance, it looks like. We're even though our economy is going through a rough patch, we still seem to be the best economy in the country. I do want to move to an area that very few people know about. I know you travel there, which is Africa, and we're getting a lot more press now on Africa as being the next great place to go, almost like the I was reading a history book the other day, and it was talking about the California Gold Rush, and I stopped for just a moment. I thought about Africa because I know that's one of the is a mineral rich country, and that's one of the things they found over there is more gold reserves. What do you think about Africa?
You know, I think only speculative money should go there, mainly because you're dealing with jurisdictions that have. You know, we talk about the problems with China, and going back to the 78-79 period, there was economic reforms put in place and very little in terms of political reforms. There is no rule of law, and that remains the largest risk within China. And it's the same in Africa, only there's been very little in terms of economic reforms and certainly not political reforms either. So when I say taking speculative money to an environment like that, it's because you have to be willing to part with every dollar invested in that kind of a jurisdiction, regardless of the country. And whether you're talking about, I mean, again, north, south, east, west, there's been more reforms in Tanzania than probably any other country. But the problem is that goes back 10, 15, 20 years, and political systems have become much more socialized once again, where the mineral wealth and the resource wealth of those countries has it looks to most politicians like low-hanging fruit, something they want to tax more, something they want to. In the case of South Africa, the ANC, the African National Congress, has talked about nationalizing the mines here in recent months. So you do have political risk in these areas. I frankly am only interested in putting real money in places where you have strong history of the rule of law. That to me is paramount for an investor, where you know that a company and contracts are going to be respected, and you do not have those assurances in a place like Africa. So yes, you could see massive wealth created, but I would only be putting nickels and dimes there, speculative money, because honestly, it is real money that focuses on asset preservation and bargain hunting in strong jurisdictions that I think is ultimately going to grow significantly and substantially over long periods of time.
I think that's very well put. Where do you see opportunity, David? Well, I mean, as you look out over the economic landscape and as you take a world view, which you do, where are you seeing opportunity to place capital right now?
You know, I think with some patience, I think the U.S. market is going to be very significant in terms of a value proposition, but that's probably 2014, 2015, 2016. And, you know, I think for the intergenerational investor, if you're a trader, that doesn't really sound interesting to you. But for the long-term investor, to take a conservative tack, some combination of cash and precious metals in the interim, and allow for that value proposition to emerge in the U.S. markets, We have an amazing capital market, and then there does need to be a cleanup. Obviously, there's been corruption at the highest levels, and I would say that's more in Washington than it is on Wall Street. But as that gets cleaned up over the next one or two or even three election cycles, I think you come back to one of the strongest capital markets in the world here in the United States for big investors. Now, in the short run, where are things of value? Yeah, as we see change take place in China, they're going to be less competitive. So as China is less competitive in terms of the goods that they offer, you're going to see a migration to lower cost producers. That's Malaysia, that's Vietnam, that's sort of the outlying countries within Asia who do have sort of the ability to produce goods at a very inexpensive rate. Something that China, believe it or not, is actually giving up.
Wow. Wow. Well, speaking of precious metals, because I was interested in your comment there that a person might want to look at precious metals and cash here short term. And I, like you, believe that I think we're in for a rough patch next year in the U.S. market. What is your thought? I would be remiss without asking you what your thought is on gold and silver, because those are areas that you are certainly a renowned expert. What is your thought on gold right now?
Well, we continue to sit the fence in terms of a macroeconomic picture here in the United States, where you have deflationary trends and deleveraging, which is likely to occur in specific sectors, specifically where there's more leverage and debt associated. And so you have this sort of deleveraging element, and that would encourage us to keep a higher percentage in cash. We saw when we were in Asia, the GIC, one of the sovereign wealth funds in Singapore, tripled their allocation to cash here in the last week or two, and that to me is it resonates. We should have a higher allocation to cash, and as a wealth management company, we do have a higher allocation to cash. We also see that central banks around the world, and the Fed's not excluded from that, have very few options. You know, sort of this liquidity trap where really all they can do from this point forward is print and monetize. And so with very few options, I think a portfolio should reflect central bank proactivity over the next 2 to 3 years as a means of sort of bailing out the markets. So we sit the fence, as I say, between sort of these big inflationary and big deflationary themes. And it sounds really boring having a lot in cash and having a lot in precious metals, but to us that is a fairly defensive posture, and we're looking forward to the day where we can more proactively allocate those capitals from a defensive posture to a more offensive posture.
I completely agree. David, how do people get a hold of you? I assume just the website, www.mcilvaney.com?
Yeah, that's the best way to keep in touch with us. You know, we'll have a 20-minute DVD segment, a film segment that we did while we were in Asia, available here in the next 3 or 4 weeks, and it'll be sort of a synopsis, big picture of Asia, the risks implied specifically to the U.S. Treasury market and the U.S. dollar. Our focus on Asia isn't really from a standpoint of value or bargain hunting, but because we see the primary risk is a knock-on effect to the U.S. Treasury market and the U.S. dollar. So stay tuned for that. Keep in touch with us at McIlvaney.com. Our weekly commentary is available every Wednesday. And then, of course, that DVD segment, if we have your email, you'll be the first to receive it.
I will mention that several times over the week. David, thank you so much for being with us again. Your comments are spot on. Appreciate you taking the time being with us. Thank you, sir.
Glad to be back with you, Mike.
Have a great day. Bye-bye. All right, folks, I'll be back with a few closing comments in just a moment. Stay tuned.